So hopefully the speaker system works for everyone. So we are in escrow, I suppose it's called, to buy this church in Redwood City. And it's a big step for us as a community. And one of the things I've been doing all along for years now, but especially now at this point, in the juncture of our community, is looking at my intention behind buying the church. And this is something that in Buddhist practice we focus on a lot, is at various points when we have to make decisions or act in the world, is we look at the intention of why we're doing what we're doing. There could be other things we need to investigate, look a little bit at the consequences of the action, the likely consequences that might happen. But from the spiritual point of view of Buddhism, one of the important analysis is to understand very well, what motivates you or us or anyone to do what they do. Because the motivations that are unwholesome tend to bring unwholesome results. And motivations which are wholesome tend to bring wholesome results. So, especially when there's major, significant decisions to be made, to look at, really look at the intentions. And there could be layers of different intentions and motivations that go on. There can be what appears on the surface, is a good idea. And then we start digging under the surface and find out that sometimes the intentions might be self-serving, and sometimes they might come from some deep sense of kind of altruistic service to others. And we all know examples, I think, of people or ourselves perhaps, where we might want to do something good for a neighbor or a friend or someone, but the primary motivation is not necessarily to help someone, but rather to look good. So it's really self-serving for ourselves. The motivation is really for our own image. Maybe we don't want to stop helping our friend because we've noticed that there's some self-serving motivation as part of it. But it's very important to recognize that's there. Because especially if it's unrecognized, then the karmic consequences are said to be much greater, since ignorance has a karmic consequences in Buddhism. So what I wanted to talk about today was just this notion of intention and karma. I think karma has entered into the English language well enough. I see the word popping up in the newspapers and magazines on a pretty regular basis. It's that person's karma to have hit 57 home runs or whatever it might be. And when the Buddha was presenting his teaching in ancient India, he was doing it in an environment where there was a lot of different discussion about what karma is and what causality and agency, human agency, is about. And from the Buddhist point of view, karma is not a theory about past lives. So it's not certainly past lives is something that Buddha and Buddhists often believe in. But the theory of karma is not meant to be something, explanation about past lives. You don't have to believe in past lives or future lives to understand karma. It's also not a theory of justice, which many of us would like, because we see that people around us in the world doing horrible things. And it would be nice if we could be absolutely confident that they're going to get their just deserts. And, certainly the theory of karma suggests that they will get something in return. Unwholesome acts bring unwholesome results. But there's some guarantee that there's some kind of magic kind of scorecard in the sky that's keeping track of everything, and everyone will get, equal amount of returns based on what they've done. I don't think that the Buddha's teaching of karma is meant to be understood that way, though it's going to be very reassuring if we understand it that way. And karma is also not meant to be some kind of idea of predeterminism, that things are predetermined, or kind of a little bit connected to that, the theory of karma is not supposed to be understood to mean that once you've done something, there's nothing you can do. in terms of avoiding the results of that action. So if you do something today, then you set in motion a karmic momentum that's then predetermined based on what you did today. There's no way of getting around it, because you committed a lie today, and because you were a lie today, in the next lifetime you're going to be born mute. No, you know, just whatever, you know. There's a direct, absolute, unwavering, mechanical, causal connection. The Buddha said that if that was the case, then there would be no room for the spiritual life. Because part of the spiritual life is to be able to have an impact on our well-being and to change the flow, the momentum, the cause and effect flow of our actions and their results. And so we might not be able to have some ultimate or thorough, complete change in the consequences of what we've done today, but we can shape the future, and we can change the karmic stream by our spiritual practice. So he said, there's no spiritual practice without the ability to change that karmic stream. So the Buddha also then defined, for the Buddha, he defined karma by the word cetana. And cetana is a Pali word for intention or motivation. So the theory of karma is a theory of intention. And intention is meant to be something we study in the present moment. It's something that happens in the present moment. Any present moment is said to have an intention as part of that moment. Or say differently, every mind moment, in Buddhist psychology, every mind moment, that mind moment, in that mind, there's the operating of intention. And what is the intention that operates? Mostly we're unconscious of it, and it goes along, kind of unaware of it. I was really struck when I left the monastery, Tassajara, after being there almost 3 years. It was an environment where everything, a lot of my life was choreographed. How you stood, and how you sat, and how you ate, and when you put down your spoon, and when you picked it up, and when you did this and that, you know, how you stepped over a threshold of a door. Everything was choreographed. You had to, Zen monastery is the training is in the forms of the monastery. And so you learn all these forms you have to put your body through. And also there was a very particular schedule that was well choreographed throughout the whole day. There was some free time during the day, but the wake up was like somewhere between 4 and 4:30, and you just follow the bells through the day. And when I left that very choreographed, kind of regimented environment, one of the big surprises for me was that I was no longer, that now I had to choose for myself all these things that were chosen for me by the monastery. It was very powerful to have these things chosen for me by the monastery, but it was even more powerful to leave the monastery and suddenly be faced with the fact that many things before that I took for granted, never thought about, suddenly I had to think about or be aware of or conscious that there was choice involved. So something as simple as how I sat in the chair, there was choice involved. Before I went to the monastery, I never thought about it. You sit in the chair. I mean, you know, what's so complicated about that? You just sit down and, you know. But actually how you sit in the chair, there's a lot of choice. About, do you use the backrest? Do you slump? Do you sit up straight? There's many, many ways of sitting in a chair. And when we sit down to sit in the chair, many of us, I think, in the normal course of our life, are not that conscious, unless we have a bad back or something, about how we sit in the chair. But very subtly, you know, how we cock our head, or how we cross our arms, or all kinds of things, are intentional acts from the point of view of Buddhism. And you have a choice whether to sit that way or not to sit that way, have your arms crossed or not crossed, or have your, you know, all kinds of ways. So when I left the monastery, I was kind of blown away by all the different choices I had, and the choices had consequences. I've noticed in my life something as simple as sitting in a chair, that at times it can make a big difference to my mood, how I sit in the chair or on a couch. I remember once being very depressed, and I noticed after a while that I was slumping. I was like the ultimate couch potato. Like my shoulders were down in the, you know, the corner of the couch, and it was so dramatic, the slumping, that I thought, well, let's try something different. And I sat up straight on the couch. And it wasn't, you know, and it doesn't often work this way, but just sitting up straight brought some kind of energy and livening to me. And that particular depression went away. And if I had just indulged in the way, kind of, in the old slumping way of sitting, it probably wouldn't have changed my mood. So in every mind moment, there's said to be an intention. And part of the function of mindfulness practice is not to make us kind of hyper-conscious of every moment and every choice we make, but is to, kind of in a natural way, begin highlighting that intention is part of our life, that choices and motivation are something that goes on all the time, and that we can start becoming more sensitive to the choices that we make moment by moment. If you go on a longer Vipassana retreat, there's a whole series of instructions that unfolds day by day for the practice. And some of it, first there's, you know, just there's a training in how to develop stability and mindfulness on the breath, and then how to be aware of what goes on in your body, and then how to be aware of what goes on in your emotional life, and how to be aware of your thoughts, and kind of filling in kind of the range of our humanity, how to sit present in the middle of it all. And at some point during the retreat, if it's a long enough retreat, it's common to give instructions to, okay, now start paying attention to your intention, to your choices you make. And it can be really fascinating on retreat to do this, to sit there at a meal and sit there quietly, kind of looking at the food, and notice the intention that has to be there for you to pick up the food and put it in your mouth. You don't pick up the food until you see the intention. And it's really fascinating to watch the birth of the intention and the things that feed into the intention and the things that fuel and nourish the intention or stimulate the intention. And then what our relationships are to the intention, the flavors of different intentions. I mean, so with food, it's fascinating, right? Because we can have so many different intentions around food. It could be that you're just trying to nourish yourself just well enough to have enough energy and health to continue for the next few hours on the retreat or live your life you have to live. It could be the intention is to comfort yourself because, you know, it's been a rough day and it's really nice to comfort yourself. And after all, they're serving brownies today at the retreat. So it's really, you know, or maybe it's just simply a craving for pleasure. Those brownies are really great. And it was really pleasant, you know, it's so much more entertaining than my thoughts. So let's go get some more entertainment here. Let's get some more pleasure. And so the motivation can be that. It's, you know, and on retreat, it's fascinating because we're often slow down enough that the automatic pilot that often comes into play is often overridden by the mindfulness. So with eating, for example, I know for myself that I can eat on automatic pilot. And the sad thing for me, or what happens for me when I'm on automatic pilot, I often eat more than my body wants. But if I'm paying mindful attention to what's actually going on carefully within me, the body knows when to stop. One of the things I've trained myself to do, I think for my years of practice, is to try to live as much as I can in my body. And that helps a lot for me with my desires. If I'm not in my body, if I'm kind of disembodied, then it's really easy to be led around by the nose of my desires. Desires can be very compelling. But if I'm in my body a lot, I can have a desire, but the desire often has very little grabbing power because I'm settled. I'm often settled or at ease in my body enough that the kind of forward momentum, the grasping or the reaching forward of desire, the disembodied nature of desire, doesn't take over. So I can have a lot of desires. I mean, desires come. I'm kind of desire type, I think. I have, you know, desires come really easily to me. They're kind of like second nature. But because of this ability to be in my body, they just come and go. They kind of often enough, I see them just go through and say, oh, that was interesting. And, you know, another time or not now or forget that. The teachings on intention are partly a teaching of taking responsibility for the choices we make. what's happening to us in the present moment, for the most part, is not your choice. There's an aspect of the present moment where the ongoing kind of flow of our intentionality and the perceptions of the world that arise out of our attitudes affects our experience of the present moment. But we can kind of just kind of very lightly say that the present moment is just what, you know, it's kind of just given. Just the present moment just arises as it is. And then the question is, how do we relate to what's happening in the present moment? And this is, you know, I think for many of you know, is a very key aspect of mindfulness, is to learn to see the present moment as given. It's allow it to be there, kind of give yourself radical permission to let the present moment be as it is. So you have all kinds of radical thoughts arise, painful thoughts, horrible thoughts, desires. You have all kinds of impulses, you have all kinds of memories, you have all kinds of feelings and sensations in your body. And part of the training in mindfulness is to just learn how to allow that to be there without reacting to it, without pushing it away or holding on to it, and just letting it, in a sense, kind of float, let the present moment be what it is. But another part of it, of the mindfulness practice, is then to study what is our relationship to that present moment experience. If you're sitting in meditation, the primary relationship might be just simply acceptance or allowing it to be there. Outside of meditation, that's not sometimes not a good policy. You can't just accept everything you run into in your daily life. Part of the function of mindfulness then is to help us to look at what are the intentions, what are the relationships to that experience that affects our motivation. So if something happens to us in the present moment and we hate it, we have aversion to it, or we're afraid because of it, then we might make choices that are not so healthy at times. So, I mean, sometimes maybe very healthy, but if something happens in the present moment, and that present moment experience somehow affects our self-image, then if our self-image is being threatened, then we might then try to lie in order to bolster it in the face of the people around us who we want to kind of impress. There's a lot of things we might do based on how we're relating to the present moment experience. So one of the things we're asked to do in mindfulness is to understand, how am I relating to this thing right now? Am I judging it as good or bad? Am I trying to push it away? Am I afraid of it? Am I trying to hold on to it? Am I using it as a way of defining myself, defining my self-image? How do I relate to this experience? And then, having seen that somewhat clearly, hopefully, then to ask oneself, how do I then choose to act? What is the wise way of responding to this thing? If I really drop down to my deepest wishes inside of myself, the deepest kind of place that I know inside of me, what intention do I have for this particular circumstance? And I know for myself that if I do that analysis, or that questioning, that often I come to a very different understanding of what I want to do in a given situation. Yesterday I was doing something very uncomfortable for myself, and for me it was very uncomfortable. It had to do with driving all over Berkeley, and it was a tremendous amount of traffic, and complicated stuff. But I didn't really want to be there. I didn't want to do this stuff. I mean, driving this car, and it took a little moment to reflect. Why was I doing this? Why was I driving around Berkeley? What was the motivation, the intention for doing it? And the intention, what I was doing was I was going to a pharmacy to pick up medicine for someone who was very sick. And so my intention was to help this person who was very sick, to help. She's, you know, struggling a lot and in a lot of suffering and kind of bedridden. And so how can I help this person? And when I was very clear in my intention, trying to be helpful to this person, the traffic didn't matter anymore. The fact that I was driving around just didn't matter. And I was just so happy that I was able to try to do something for someone who was in distress. So now I'm looking these days at my intention around buying this church. And one of the things that I've noticed is that there are many intentions, mixed intentions. So what do we do then? How do we sort through all the different intentions that might be there? And sometimes there are layers of intention. And you know, the intention to, you know, the, I don't know what exactly, but what to say, but you know, I might be thinking about how the center is going to be painted, and I really want it to look good. Why do I want it to look good, the painting, you know? Is it because, you know, when we invite guest teachers down, my colleagues, I really want to show them and we've done a good job and, you know, we have a cool place? And or is it because having a nice color and painting on the building is makes it feeling inviting to people, welcoming to people? And if it looks welcoming to people, then people make it easier for people to come. And often people who are new and have never been to a place, it's not so comfortable to come into a new place. And so to have a painting that looks kind of comfortable. But what's the intention of wanting to make it welcoming, the paint job, so people feel welcomed? Well, then very quickly you find it tied down to for me at least, one of the most fundamental reasons for buying the church. And that is, I want to help people suffer less. And my idea is that having a church is going to be optimize our ability as a community, and myself as a teacher, to help our wider community suffer less, the individuals who come. And so that intention then ties into buying a church. That intention then informs how I want to paint the building. That intention might inform the painters that we hire maybe to do the painting, because, you know. Anyway, so intention is multifaceted. And what I'm trying to point to, kind of maybe not so well here, is that we can start studying that the intentions behind the intention, the motivations behind the motivation, what's going on deep down. And sometimes what we'll find is that the deeper motivation, the root of the motivations for us, are have to do with self-identity. And in some sense, they're self-serving. I'm trying to create a certain sense of self, and I want to paint that building because then I look good in the eyes of my fellow teachers. Or the intention could be more other-serving, trying to be helpful to society around us. I'm trying to paint that building so it feels welcome and people will come and suffer less. So we study these things, and if we take time with our intentions, if we spend actually some time reflecting and contemplating what our intentions are, then we increase the opportunity for us to clarify what our intentions are and try to come from intentions which are more meaningful for us, have greater value for us, and hopefully produce better results. The teachings of the Buddha is that intentional actions have consequences beyond the immediate present. It's kind of like you set up a momentum of things, of how you through your actions. Kind of like, maybe the easiest way of talking about it is we set up a habit formation. So if you always doing certain kind of activity, certain kind of intention, you're lubricating the wheels of that part of your mind, so it becomes easier in the future to act the same way. That's why if you're always acting on your desires, then you set up a momentum where you become a desiring becomes kind of happening kind of automatically. I've had the experience of kind of following up on a lot of desires, and then suddenly my basic desires, you know, all the desires I could think about were fulfilled, or you know, it came to an end. But it didn't matter, and then the desiring was still there. And I had to find something to fill the desire. So one little intention of desire might be innocent enough. But if it becomes a lifestyle, if it becomes a day of kind of chasing after things all the time, then the saying I like is, you know, with enough drops, the bathtub is filled. And so, you know, any given single intention might be innocent or seem minor, but the cumulative effect over a whole day or a whole lifetime is quite powerful. So if we carry with us a particular attitude about life, and we're always acting on that attitude, that attitude creates a karmic momentum of a certain habit formation that becomes easier and easier and easier to act that way in the future. Our intentions affect our body. If we have a desire or act of generosity or act of hate or act of whatever, act of anger, you can often feel it. The more sensitive you are, you can feel it in your body, how it feels. and an act of aggression will affect your body very differently than an act of love, an act of generosity. And with enough drops, the bathtub is filled. And if you spend a whole day with a lot of small little aggressive acts, if you go on 101 and are constantly, you know, upset and angry at all the other drivers, by the time you get somewhere, your body's going to be tense. And you wonder why you got a headache. But if you go on 101 and rush hour traffic and start doing loving kindness to all the other drivers and start being generous in the driving, you can go ahead of me, please. It's possible that you'll arrive in a very different state. Your body will be different because of the different ways in which the body responds to the choices we make. It's very there's often a kind of very poetic description of this, where they talk about our life is a garden, and the intentions are the seeds that we plant. And you get the kind of garden you get out of your life depends a lot on the seeds that you plant. So if you plant seeds of aggression and hate and craving and greed, and then you get a particular kind of garden out of your life. And if you plant seeds of generosity and love and compassion, then you get a very different kind of garden out of your life. So maybe starting about 5 years ago, I started thinking about imagining what I would have been like if I hadn't practiced. So I kind of imagined what I was like before I came to Buddhism. You know, I was maybe started practicing regularly when I was 21, so I was pretty young. And so I kind of imagined what I was like back then, and I kind of then imagined the trajectory I was on and what it would have been like, you know, after another 20 years or so. And I was frightened by what I thought. And I was, you know, very glad that, you know, that I had the practice that somehow changed that karmic stream, interrupted, stopped some of the old habits and patterns that I had, and substituted it with better ones. I've been told that Abraham Lincoln had this said, by the time a man is 45, he's responsible for his face. And I think what's behind that is, you know, the cumulative habits of the ways in which our attitudes and intentions and responses and ways we are in the world affect our body also. So we find ourselves where we are. That's the given. And we might not be happy with where we find ourselves and what's happened to this date, but it's just what it is, what it is. And so part of practice is to learn how to be present for it in a generous, accepting, mindful way. And then to use that mindfulness and that stability of that comes with the acceptance to then look at the intentions and hopefully act wisely with what's happening in the present. Make wise choices so that the garden can grow in a particular way. In the teachings of the Buddha, happiness, for the most part, happiness and unhappiness is said to be the result of our intentions. Freedom, however, which is a very different kind of radical, different kind of happiness than normal, conventional happiness, freedom is supported by our good intentions. Good intentions create a useful garden for freedom. But freedom is not a result of an intention. So what that means is that as a person practices, creating a good garden is very helpful. So it's very important to live ethically, for example, and create a kind of ethical garden at least. Without an ethical garden, it's very hard for freedom to occur. But at some point, we have to also realize we have to let go of all our intentions. We cannot be depending or holding on to even good intentions if we want to be free. And some people will hold on to good intentions as a form of security. And they're constantly negotiating and working on figuring out, you know, what's the right thing to do here, or what's the good intention. And in order to become free, you have to let go of even your good intentions. Not once and for all, but at least in the moment where freedom is going to occur. And so, especially like on deep meditation, for example, you have to be very careful to track your intentions to know when to stop having intentional mind moments, when to actually stop the flow of intentionality. It's kind of like you have to create a garden, that has maybe an apple tree, beautiful, healthy apple tree, that has a nice branch that hangs over the fence of the garden. And when the apple tree is strong enough, you plant the seed and it grows and grows and grows. And then at some point you can climb up the apple tree, strong enough to hold you, and you can climb up over the branch. And the branch kind of hangs over the fence of the garden out to the outside. And you hold on, and then you drop. And then you're free. But you need to have that strong tree to climb up and get over the edge of the fence. So there's a very important place in Buddhist practice for our intentions, studying it and getting to know it. And there's a very important place for letting go of intentions also. And without seeing our intentionality working, it's very hard, clearly, being very familiar with it, it's very hard to know when the moment is to let go of it entirely. So those are my thoughts for today. And now it's your turn to respond. Yes?
When I find myself wanting to do something generous and becoming aware that my intention, maybe 60% of it is like wanting acknowledgement or something like that, what do you do with that?
That's a great question. What do you do you didn't say it this way, but what do you do if you notice that some of your motivation, a certain percentage of it, is unwholesome, and maybe some of it's wholesome? I find it a real pity if you sacrifice a wholesome activity, so helping a neighbor or something, because you notice that part of your mind has some unwholesome motivation tied to it. So I don't know, if it's percentage, you have to kind of figure out a little bit also what the consequences of are and what the greater good might be. And sometimes it's okay to go along and notice that you have some unwholesome motivation, you want acknowledgement, and go along with it. Okay, and kind of pat that need on the back and say, it's okay, you'll be better, you're going to get what you want right now. Because I really want to help this neighbor also, so I'm going to go and help the neighbor and not sacrifice it. Was that clear enough? I was confused, huh? I'm sorry. Was I confused earlier today in my talk? No, just this was confused, huh? Should I try again? Try again? Someone's gonna try for me. Sure, could be. Or how mindful you are. Because sometimes when we act what's seemingly spontaneous, if the mindfulness is much higher, you would have seen that there was a whole kaleidoscope of motivations that happened very fast. So what I was trying to say is that sometimes our motivations can be mixed. There can be many, many different motivations that go into wanting to do the same act. And if you notice that it's an unwholesome motivation is one part of it, then you have to decide what you're going to do. Are you going to not do the act because a certain percentage of it is unwholesome? Or are you going to act on that 40% or 60% which is wholesome? And each of you are going to have to decide for yourself. But I know I act sometimes on things where I notice that there are something unwholesome motivation as part of it, because I think actually the greater good is done by acting on it. And I'm not going to sacrifice the greater good by protecting or kind of just avoiding my little bit of neurosis that's part of it. However, I'll try to be very honest about that neurotic motivation, for example, and then try to study it and try to maybe clarify it in other times or try to work with it, or depending if I have time or whatever. I'm not going to just kind of be naive about it also. Please. Well, this is what I mentioned earlier, that if you act on an intention without knowing it, you create, if it's an unwholesome act, you create a greater negative karma than if you act on it with knowing you're acting on it. Ignorance itself, the act of ignoring what's going on, it creates negative karma. So if you don't have the ignorance as part of it, then you're creating less negative karma. So I think if you clearly see what's going on, chances are that you're mitigating it to some degree, lessening the consequences. Yes?
Can I struggle with putting myself, like getting myself in a situation where I'm...
Yeah. That's a very good question. I don't know if there's any clear guidelines that I could give on that kind of situation, because it's kind of it's a judgment call often. But one of the things that I will do in a situation like that is look at my intentions and my reactions. It could be that as I'm reflecting, you know, what's enough here? What should I do here? That I might be impatient because I'm really trying to get to the movies on time, and so. And I don't want to be late for the previews, you know, or something. And so my impatience, you know, my desire to get someplace else begins to creep into the situation and can become stronger the less of an emergency it is. If I can be aware of my reactions, my responses, my other intentions, my other desires and wishes, or perhaps fears comes into play. Initially, there was no fear at all because it's obvious this person is in distress. But as you're walking the person home, and you realize you're kind of walking down an alley, you know, or, you know, you say, well, and suddenly you start, or fear comes up, or you start worrying, is this ever going to end? You know, this person seems to be constantly asking for more and more and more. So, or maybe the person's not asking for more, just that, you know, fear operates, you know, once the initial crisis is over, fear is a kind of attitude we tend to walk around with. And so it kicks in. And that affects our analysis of the situation. So the mindfulness will help us understand all the different streams of thoughts and attitudes and reactivity that feed into the choice we're going to make. And sometimes there can be many, many different streams. But if you understand some of the different streams, then you might have greater clarity about which streams are giving you useful information and which streams are not useful. Thinking about the previews and getting there in time probably is not a useful stream to think about when is enough in helping this lady. Was that clear? Enough? Am I being clear now? I'm worried now. was that helpful? Let's ask that question. Sort of, yeah, not so much. But let other people answer the question, because it was a great question.
You know, for me in that situation, the intention that's in conflict is whether my intention is I want to help or I want to do the right thing. And so that idea of wanting to do the right thing gets in the way of finding what the right thing is.
Beautiful. Great. Someone else?
I really liked what you said about being in the body, not being so subject to desire when you're in your body. But for me, it's kind of like, I like the phrase, the body never lies. And if I can stay in my body, then I get away from all of the confusing, is it this, is it that, is it good, is it nasty, is it selfish, and so forth. And that's what meditation has helped me with, is finding identifying a feeling in my body that has a ring of truth to it. And the trick is to take the time to get in touch with it, because I'm not always there.
Right. Great. Please.
A few weeks ago, I think it was Misha, she was saying that you want to be able to have, I'm not going to say it like she did, but you want to have the same reaction whether somebody says something good to you or something bad to you. And I was just kind of thinking on the two things, like, you know you're doing something to help somebody, but you also think that you're doing it because you want them to like you or whatever. What if they came back and said, you're such a rotten person, I hate what you did for me? You know, that wouldn't feed the part of you that was hoping to get the appreciation. Yet, you know you still did the right thing. So maybe if you can temper your reaction, mm-hmm. that's feeding, the unwholesome part of it is feeding, then you can just know that you did the
right
thing, regardless of
what. Right. So it's very important what you said. Part of the value of really understanding our intentions well is then we can fall back on knowing that the take kind of a sense of refuge or to get some sense of well-being, that our intentions were good. And even though other people are criticizing us, and sometimes even if the acts turn out to hurt someone inadvertently. You know, you might feel regret and remorse about having someone being hurt, but it actually helps to know that your intention was a good one. Yes?
Well, it seems to me we're very good at beating ourselves up, and the idea that we may not be doing enough or we may be doing too much or whatever. If we can give ourselves the same kind of compassion we can give the people that we're helping, maybe that would help us a little bit too.
That's very nice. He said that if we can give ourselves as much compassion as the person we're helping, then that can help or mitigate the problems that often come in when we're being very hard on ourselves or harsh with ourselves. Right.
What do you mean by free?
The ultimate freedom of Buddhism is a consciousness which is not related to anything. Most of the time, our consciousness, our moments of consciousness, are related to things all the time. So, to say very simply, right now your hearing consciousness is related to my speaking. You're oriented towards it, and hearing cannot be oriented in any particular direction. It can just be open and free in all directions, and whatever comes by itself. But it's not oriented in any one direction. It's not oriented towards anything. It's not related to anything. So when consciousness is not relating to anything at all, anywhere in the universe.
So by letting go of intention,
right. And the intention is always a little bit directed into the future. So you can't completely let go. If you're involved with an intention, the consciousness is then relating to something. If there's an intention, last one, yeah.
So at that point, you're free of karma.
At that point, are you free of karma? Yeah. At that moment, you're not creating any karma.
You're not just fooling yourself and not thinking you are, or you really are?
Sorry?
At that moment, you're not.
Well, there's no intentionality, so there's no karma to be created.
But if you're acting, I mean, if you're doing something, you're still not creating it?
Oh, this gets into Buddhist theory that I don't feel very qualified. I mean, I know the theory is, but I don't know if you're interested in it.
Another time.
The theory is that someone who's fully enlightened acts in the world without intention. But I've never met someone who's fully enlightened, so I couldn't ask him or her if that was the case. Or what that means. I don't even know quite what it means to say that. But that's the theory. Oh, last one, please.
I'm a little confused about freedom meditation and freedom in the real world. Like, meditation seems simple. I mean, there's constructive thinking and there's meditative thinking. That's where I let be and I'm free of constructive thinking. But in the world, it seems, you know, there are free moments, but constructive thinking is still going on.
Right. Right. I'm not sure what you mean by constructive thinking, but a mind which doesn't relate, a consciousness which doesn't relate to anything, could still have thinking. It just the consciousness is not relating to the thinking. It's not oriented towards thinking. Just as it can be sounds. There can be sensations. Freedom doesn't have to be an act of cessation, with a seizing of all things. Freedom can also be inclusive of all things, but the mind is not oriented or relating to any of those things. So it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to involve the seizing of thinking, but there can't be any latching onto the thoughts. And most thoughts are. you know, are we're latching onto them. You know, you probably heard me distinguish between thinking and thoughting. So thoughting can happen in an enlightened mind, but thinking probably doesn't. Thinking is when one thought grasps onto the next one, kind of. There's some attachment as part of it.
So thought is just when you think.
Yeah. It's very inadequate, my response to you, for me. So. we should end before I get too much over my head or something. And it's nice to come down here on Labor Day weekend and see you all, and I'll be back next week.